Blog Talk Radio.
Why must we feel our futures so uncertain? Why must we feel our presence is a burden? Living day to day off crumbs from the table, this dependency must end. I know that we are able to build a life
that's
new.
got it in his head. He can read the book. The light is in the book, in what he reads. The words that come out of his mouth, that's what the light is. But there ain't no light in his head. Yeah, that's what they're saying about him. You think they didn't dress him up like that to mock him? They dressed him up like that to mock him. Can you think they can be praising the preacher and put his collar backwards and everybody else's frontwards? The banker's collar's frontwards. The scientist's collar's frontwards. The governor's collar's on front. The preacher's is back. That can't all make no sense. And a window in his throat. The throat is the place where you have no conscience. The senses are in the mouth, in the head, in the body, not the throat. If you eat something bad for you, the only way the throat will deal with it is when it starts to kill the throat. It can be poison. It can be nasty. Throat will let it down. But if it pains the throat physically, the throat wants to throw it out. Or hurry up and swallow it to get that pain out. If the throat thinks it can send it down, throat don't care what it's going to do to the bottom. No, the throat just want to get it out of the throat. If the throat thinks it can get it down quick, it get it to the swallow. And saying, okay, out the system. Throat represents the instinctive spiritual impulse that doesn't have rational grasp. So the mouth is intelligent. The mouth tastes. In fact, the nose, it's a watchman. It checks what goes into it. It want to know if it looks all right, but the smell is, smell okay. The nose want to check it out before it go in. Even go into the mouth. And the mouth gets it, and the mouth tastes it. And if it tastes like it ain't right, mouth, look. Spit it out. But when you get excited, you act impulsively. And the throat then is a check, right? The throat is a check when your senses are not working. The throat is a check. So it's like a last check. You go real hairy. The vision, the eyes, the mind didn't catch it. When you put it in the mouth, the senses in the mouth didn't catch it. Because you had blinded your senses by desperate appetite. Right? So you put it in the mouth. Thing was too big. Needs to be chewed a little bit. You're almost dead. The throat said, hey, this is too much. So the throat represents a blind discipline, an attack on your instinct, not on your intelligence. Check on your instinct, not on your intelligence. That's what the throat represents in this symbolic language. Okay? So the preacher wears a collar on his neck and is turned backwards, meaning that he's not in conscious control of his instincts. His instincts are being manipulated. And really, the knowledge is not his. The knowledge is in his voice. But also, it's a play what on the language. That really, light doesn't start in the heart or here. Light starts in expression. If you can't express something, there's no light. I don't care what you think about. Until you form it in your mind, structurally, intelligently, having some kind of rational, visible, definable form in your mind, when you express it, it's nothing. It ain't light in your head, and it ain't light out here. But if you can form it in some kind of expressive way where it conveys something as a language conveys something, as right language, it's clear in your mind, you have knowledge in your head, it's light here, it's light out there. So they're playing on two things, that the word is the light, and the word forms in the throat. And the preacher, that's where his knowledge, that's where his power is, that's where the controls are, in the language. But his light is there. The light is there for him in his throat, the window seat light in his throat, meaning that also that his knowledge is not in his head, it's in his throat. The higher they go, the different kind of dress they wear. The higher they go up in the order. They get so high in the order, they wear all white. Is that right? All white. Some of them wear all red. Red, mostly red. Gold and white. They wear different colors. They go up. But the lowest dress of their, in that order is black, collar turned backwards, and a white window in the front. Now, he has a white window in the front. But does he really have the white window? No. It's just a symbol there showing you what knowledge is in the word and the language. He doesn't have a white window. Go to the church and you see stained windows. Stained windows. Not white. What does stained windows mean? Stained windows, what does stain mean? Stain means to impair, to hurt, to spoil, to mess up in some kind of way. Is that right? Stain is stain. So stain has different meanings, but this is one of its meanings. To impair, to hurt, to mess up in some way. The stain. Now, he has stained windows. What? Why stained windows? If the, his house is made of stain, have stained windows, that tells me something about his mentality. His mentality is not life. His mentality is symbolism. Stain means symbolic. He can't see the light out there because he lives in symbolism. And his symbolism set him out in the light. Can they look out the church windows and see what's happening outside? No, they can't. When they're in church, you can't see outside. Right or wrong? Yeah, you live in, you got stained windows. When you're in a church, you can't see outside. But look, also the person outside can't see the church. The person outside can't see the church. And that's true. If your mind ain't like those people, you say, I don't know what they see in that. Yeah, I don't know what they see in that, man. I ain't never been even going along with that. Yeah, so those who are in can't see out, and those who are out can't see in. Now, live in stained windows. Look at the word window. Window. Oh, brother, it's just window. Now, what you going to get out of that, brother, man? Wind. W-I-N-D. Wind. That's what I'm going to get out of it. Wind. A window. Now, the common people, they don't call door door. They call it door. And isn't it a door? It's a door for light. A door for air. Right? But for the church, it's not, and for the Christian people, for the Western world, it's not a light door. It's a wind door. It ain't an air door. It's a wind door. Now, shouldn't they call it air door? We don't want to get wind. When we open the window, we want to get air. Or we want to get light. We want to get fresh air, or we want to get light. But they don't call it an air door. A light door, they call it a window. And you know what most of us call, we don't say no door. Door. Close the door, man. Open the door. Window. All right. So it's a window. What is wind? Excited mind. Excited mind. See, air is more calm. It's calmer. We don't say that. We don't say let in the air if it's storming out there, man. We say shut out the wind, right? Hey, man, close the window, shut out the wind. We don't call it air when it's all excited, when it's raging. So wind means excited mind or raging mind. Now, tell me something. Doesn't the church make your mind excited? They heighten the excitation in your mind. That's their purpose. The whole theatrics is designed to excite your mind until you become so confused in your senses. See, you can heighten the activity of the mind until it becomes too fast to register on the intelligence. It becomes too fast for registering in the intelligence. So then you become dizzy, hypnotized, spellbound, right? You go into a frenzy, you fall out. Why? Because your mind has been put beyond its ability to deal with what's happening. And just like you turn a child around or turn a person around real quick and they're trying to see, people who know how to train their eyes can turn around all day and never get dizzy, right? Because they know how to train their eyes. But those that don't know how to train their eyes for spinning, when they spin, the environment, the scenery is passing by their mind so fast that it confounds the senses and make them lose equilibrium. They lose equilibrium. So the person who's being spun around physical in a physical environment, he loses physical equilibrium. The person who's being spun around in his mind, rational mind, loses rational equilibrium. And they know how to make you do that by increasing the excitation. Increasing the excitation. So the windows are called windows. Windows. Windows of the houses of America. And they used to call the levels you live on stories. Stories. First story, second story, 25th story. Just a lot of stories. And windows. Right? Okay, who would mock our life like that? Tell me, who would make a mockery of our existence like that? To call the levels we live on stories, lies, and call the things we look in and out to see what's approaching and what's happening, wind, W-I-N-D, window. And the one that we go in to worship God, stained window. Not clear windows, stained windows. You ought to think about that. All right, let's go on now. I'm sorry to hold you so long here like this. As I said, anybody can leave if they want to. It's okay. Now, look. Let's go to the shoes now. Shoes are called shoes. And I don't care what other word we use, shoes stay in existence. We use a lot of other words for shoes. Loafers, sandals, mules. You know shoes used to be called mules? M-U-L-E-S, mules. They're telling us something about the masses. The feet in the whole establishment represents the lowest of all the people. The feet represent the lowest of all the people. And they wear shoes. And here the man at a certain period in the progress of the thinking of society, or the seasonal or fashionable thinking of the society, which is their seasonal cultural mind. At a certain time, he referred to what they were wearing on their feet as mule. A mule is an ass. A dumb thing. Yes, mule is an ass. A dumb thing. So he was saying, now we have made the masses asses. Asses. The word shoe goes back to ancient Egypt, to ancient Egyptian mythology. It's not spelled S-H-O-E. Look at the word itself, S-H-O-E. Where can you find a word, another word in English language, that that rule fit into, or that fits into that rule for spelling. There are many rules for spelling. But where is that rule to pronounce S-H-O-E, shoot? I don't know that rule. That's one by itself. Shoot. S-H-O-E, shoot. But in Egyptian mythology, it's S-H-U, shoot. They call it S-H-O-E, shoot. And what was shoot? What is shoot in Egyptian mythology? Shoot in Egyptian mythology represents the spiritual ascension. The spirit of man, the spirit of man in its ascendancy. The spirit of man in its ascendancy. Now, life, the growth of life, must begin with a spirit, a feeling, a desire, a spirit for elevation. So they call that truth. And believe me, nothing can happen in your rational mind until you get the feeling, the desire in you to rise up, to be better. That's why the Quran tells us, never will God change the state of a people until they first change what is bothering their heart. You must change the spirit, the attitude that's in you. You must change that first in order to get some improvement. So Shu in Egyptian mythology represented that. It represented the ascending spirit. And how does man ascend? Physically. He ascends by finding balance on his feet. I say it physically. How does a baby get up physically and stand on his feet? By learning to balance on his feet, he's able to push his whole body up. He crawls on his fours, hands and knees. He walks, he pulls himself up to something until he learns. He wobbles and wiggles, but finally learns how to balance himself on his 2 feet, right? And as soon as he's born, they don't wait till he walks. As soon as he's born, they want him to have some shoes. Why? Because symbolically, they're saying with the symbolic language that the baby is born. He has inherited this spiritual instinct in him, achievement instinct in him, to bring him upon his foot. The spiritual rise to ascend is already in him when he's born. So you don't wait for the baby to, he ain't even crawling yet, and he got on his shoes. Right? Yeah? Now, you know, I used to wonder, why they put shoes on a baby that ain't even crawling yet? They got his feet all funky, all squeezed up in those shoes, and the baby ain't even crawling. He ain't thinking about walking. He ain't even crawling. And they got him on shoes. Doesn't make sense, does it? Doesn't make no kind of sense at all. It's only symbolic. It only makes sense in symbolism. No sense in reality at all. Now, so, look, truth is the name always, because that is really the truth, meaning in the symbolic language of man's evolution or ascendancy, that's true. It represents the spirit to ascend, the spirit to rise up, and to gain balance. You can't stand without balance. The baby has to learn balance in order to stand, and learning balance, it learns to walk. But it has to have balance. So what is the key for ascension, for ascending up? Balance. But there's also another key. What is the other key? Power. It ain't easy. The baby has to, you have strength. Mm-hmm. You strength, muscle his way up, right? Takes muscle, strength. So he has to have balance and power. Balance and power. He has to exert himself, and he has to also use his intelligence to keep a balance, right? Now think about that. If those are the first principles in getting up, and I'm talking about in the broad general sense getting up. Now, if those are the essential principles for getting up, think about that, and tell me, isn't that what we need in the masses, in the American masses, in the world masses? Don't we need to teach them to turn back to their origin, to their development in the origin of life, and learn that first you must learn to discipline yourself intelligently. You must be cautious. You must be attentive. You must be thinking You must be alert. You must be controlled. You must be conscious of your whole presence to keep everything in right check. Balance yourself and use force. Apply energy. Use force. Exert yourself. That's what we got to do. We have to be powerful. We have to be powerful. We have to exert ourselves. Be willing to exert force and be attentive. Be alert. Be balanced. Be in full cognizance of the whole structure. And bring it up. Bring it up. That's what we have to do. So they're telling us with symbolic language that the same principles that evolved you naturally, God did that. Didn't nobody teach the baby to do that. God did that. The same principles that evolved you naturally are the principles you need to succeed in this life. That's what it's telling us, brothers and sisters. And I could talk on this for a long, long time. I'm telling you, because we just opened up a whole new subject. No, we're not going to do it. I'm going to keep going. We're talking about clothes. Now, what do we say? When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on shoes. Didn't say new. Didn't say clogs. Didn't say sandals. Say shoes. When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on shoes. But in the Islamic heaven, it's sandals, not shoes. Sandals. Another word, another subject. On the same subject, though. Yes. When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on shoes and walk all over God's heaven. You can walk when you've got intelligence and balance and power to exert your will. You can do it. You can't make no progress if you ain't got that. It means I'm going to progress when I get to heaven. I'm going to have a big, wide field for progress because I'm going to have shoes. I hope that registers. Now, let me see here where we are. All right. Another word, loafers. Now, if you don't have initiative, get up and go. Courage, incentive to exert yourself. And discipline, mental discipline. Most likely you're going to be a loafer. Right? So they put you on loafers. When they want you to stop exerting yourself, look, we don't need these masses. We don't need all this doggone production. Too much of it. And if we don't reduce their intelligence level, they'll become a problem for us. They demand too much. So now we don't need them in production. We don't need all these people to do intelligent work. Come on. Change those shoes to mules. Change them to clogs. Whatever. Change them to wedgies. You know they used to be called wedgies? Yeah. Look up in the dictionary and tell you. Wedgies. What is wedgie? A duck foot is wedge. Mm-hmm. And his foot feet are wedge for swimming. So wedgies mean put him in the water. Take him out of rational thought and put him into church thought. Wedgie. Make a duck out of him. You know about the 13 ducks. Drinking up all the water from Caveman Lake. Any of you know about that? Let's see the hands of those who recognize that language. Yes. Yeah. Hey, 13 ducks were made to drink up the water in the Caveman Lake. Now, here, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's teacher, Farad, is using symbolism again. Duck is an animal that loves water better than he loves air and land. But he's able to go on land, in the air, and water. Some ducks can even go down deep into the water. Like a fish. They fly out of the air, dive down under the surface of the water, and go deep in the water. Pick up a fish and come back up to the top.
Sit on the top and fly. You're aware of that, aren't you? I have seen that. I read about them, and I've also seen them do that. Yeah, summed up, they do that. All right. They are able to get around in the land and, or in the air, but their special habitat is the water. That's what they love. When they're in the water, they're happy. And the duck is a highly sensitive animal. Now, I'm not talking about the duck on the farm. I'm talking about the duck on the McDonald's farm. That's you, not you. Okay? So the duck is a highly sensitive animal, and he walks. He's just shaking all the time. You ever notice a duck? And he just talking? Yeah, you know, ain't nobody around half that. What? And when you can't handle the work that you're trying to do, they call you a quack. Right? A quack. What does that symbol represent in religion? Prophet Muhammad, he just got it from the language source. He got a peep into what was happening. He was a member of the Jacobites, which I believe. what does it represent? The duck. You know, what, he traced the word down. Duck. What is another meaning for duck? To look out. To be careful. To be alert. Move before you get hit. You see? Duck. You see? And the duck got that name, they say, because he ducks his head under the water. And even sometimes in the water, he'll duck his head. You notice the duck be walking? And he'll duck his head down like that and come back up. You know, he has done it so long in the water, I guess he just got a habit of doing it even when he ain't in the water. Duck and come back up. And his feet are yellow. His feet are yellow. Now, see, these people that does this making of the language, the symbol manipulators, they are wise. And they study very carefully a thing before they include it in a language context. So, the yellow feet goes along with what? Wisdom. It will stand for wisdom. Not that the duck is wise. Don't no nut go out here now and say the duck is wise feet, man. Well, the duck ain't nothing but a symbol a man used to say something through. Yeah, so the duck got yellow feet and yellow mouth. Yellow feet and yellow mouth. Orange, really, it's orange-like. But yellow, they say yellow. Yellow feet, or orange-yellow feet, and orange-yellow mouth. It means his knowledge is in his feet and in his expression, in his language. In his feet, what that means? In his ascendant spirit. He has a knowledge of the spirit that has caused him to ascend. Spirit that is in his nature that caused him to grow and ascend. That spirit is inherited out of nature, if you understand. Now, there's a lot to be said, but we're trying to rush. Now, he has that science, and because of that science, he has the ability to express it in his language. He's also got an ability to vocalize it, to express it in his language. So that's what the duck represents. Now, who called him a quack? That shouldn't be no quack. Got all that knowledge? Why is he a quack? If he's a quack, because his school or his society has been confused by those who have supplanted them. They have been supplanted. The duck is referring to who? Christ and his disciples. Not Christ the person, but the order, the Christian top order, Christ and his disciples. 13 ducks, say 13 ducks. Drank the water of the cave man's lake. So what does it mean? It means now we have given the black man the same mind that we gave the select few that we took out of the Gentile civilization to lead the world. We have now given that same mind to the black man of America. Just like you had your leadership in 13, and believe me, the cabinet of the president, the political order is also copied after that order, 13, right? 13.
13 people. So it represents Western leadership. So he was saying that the same thing that you did to the Jews that you selected for the Gentile world, we have now, the same thing that we, our fathers, did to the few that we selected from the Gentile world to rule the world, we have now done it to the blacks of America. And just like you struggle with our knowledge to come into real, clear, rational grasp of what we have and became a quack, they are going to do the same thing, and they are also going to be quack. They'll have the knowledge, the science that we have, we pass it on to them in their feet. What is the science of the feet? Progress naturally. Accept the nature, the natural order of things. Isn't that what the Prophet Elijah Muhammad taught his followers? Say, look, you must have food, clothes, shelter. You must have some of this good earth. You must have knowledge, the same knowledge they have, the sciences and everything. Isn't that what he told them? That's putting your feet on the ground. That's giving you the inspiration to ascend upward in a natural way. All right? And he also told them, told Elijah Muhammad, things that he thought was great, great secret wisdom. Which, if you compare it with what the Bible says, it does represent a high, high understanding of much of the Bible's secret wisdom. When you compare it. Now, so he gave that to him. But Honorable Elijah Muhammad speaks, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad got a mouth of a wise man. His mouth is that of wisdom. His position is that of the learned. His feet, in Arabic, if you say his position, qadima, means position. Same word, qadim, for feet, you see? So in English it's the same, but I could give it to you quick from Arabic, and in English it takes too long to go through the history of the word. Now, so position also means feet. Feet in a position means the same. I want a foothold in this. Position in this, you see? The Honorable Elijah Muhammad's position was that of a wise man. He wants some material progress. He wants authority over himself, authority for his people. He wants some independent authority for his own people over their own destiny. That's wise talk. That's intelligent talk. Wise talk. That's the aspirations of the learned, the wise people of this earth. That's their aspirations, you see? So the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in his position, showed wisdom. And in his voice, came out what? Symbolic talk, but in its symbol, hidden meaning, was great wisdom. But in the world, what was he called? A quack. I read it in the paper. They called him a quack. I remember them calling him a quack. They called him a quack. Why? Because he wasn't given the deep insight, the clear understanding of what Farah gave him. Farah didn't give him that. He didn't give it to him. He wouldn't give it to him. So the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was left with all of his followers doing what? Trying to get that deep understanding.
That's right.
He struggled for it. And he told all his followers to do the same thing. He said, we have to study deep. The real knowledge, he said, is under the surface. He said, we have to dig deep. I've heard him say that 1,000 times. So you have to dig deep. And he would discuss it with others. And he said, maybe you got something there, brother. And he had a way of thinking. He knew his way of thinking was right, but he couldn't bring the words, the literal words, out so he could see what was hidden behind them. But he struggled for it, and he at least knew the direction. He was sure of that. The direction was to go naturally, scientifically, not spookily. He knew that. So he had that right. And no matter what they came up with, if it sounds foolish, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, no, you ain't got it yet, brother. He knew that was wrong because it didn't make natural or rational sense. See? So he was put on the right track, but he wasn't given the language. This ain't the first time that was done, and I hate to hold you, but this is good for you to have this knowledge. Should this knowledge die in me? I may die tomorrow. All right. Samson was a strong man, great warrior. He beat the army of the Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. And ask the Jews, and if they tell the truth, ask the rabbis, scholars in the Judaism or the rabbis, and if they tell the truth, they'll tell you what I'm saying is true. Samson in the Jewish religion represents a renegade, not a true man, not a true Jew. He represents a renegade. Samson was a renegade. He did what he was not supposed to do. What was that? He married a Philistine woman. He was not supposed to do that. And it doesn't mean he married a physical woman. It means he shared his knowledge with a non-Jew. But he shared it with the woman in symbolism. What is another key for it? He said, if you had not plowed my heifer, you would not have been able to get me. Plowed his heifer. And he was talking about his wife. He married a wife of the Philistines, and then the Philistines plowed his heifer. What does it mean? It means that he shared his knowledge in symbolism with the Philistine society, wife, with a certain society in the Philistine society, religious order in the Philistine society. He shared his knowledge with that religious order in their society, another order within order, a woman within a bigger woman. And he said, if you had not plowed my heifer, you would not have conquered me, would not have subdued me. What does he mean? That if you had not plowed, let me plow, took the symbolism that I shared with the religious people in your kingdom, and you plowed it. What is plowed it? Plow means digging, dig under the surface. Dig deep. If you had not set it deep and struggled mentally deep into the meaning that I, symbolic symbolism that I share with these people, you would not have found the key to my strength. That's all it's saying. That's all it's saying. Now, dear beloved brothers and sisters, so I'm telling you, it's not the first time it was done. Quran Muhammad did the same thing. He came as a Samson, a strong man of that knowledge. And he shared that knowledge in symbolism with one of the American society. And it happened to be the most oppressed, the most oppressed, the most subjected of the society, black people, right? And now, the knowledge didn't come to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad directly, came to me. But now, what will they say, the learned say, in secrecy? He would not have got that if he had not plowed our heifer. Isn't that what they were saying? Yeah. They say he would not have got that if he had not plowed our heifer. You see? So the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam was their heifer. And I plowed their heifer. I plowed their bitch to death. So they say, oh, he wouldn't have got there if he had not plowed our heifer. But they don't understand. They don't understand the power of Allah. Is Allah pleased with you? Using people to create new thoughts to change the attitude and thinking and sensitivities of the world for you to exploit? He's not pleased with that. They can't see that, no, he didn't plow our heifer. God revealed to him our heifer. They can't see it being that. No, he plowed our heifer. Allah is my witness. Actually, I didn't plow their heifer. I didn't even know where that heifer was. I went to other books, to the Quran, to the Bible, to books on mythology, sociology, psychology. I was looking for understanding. And after getting understanding, then I came back. And I saw that the language of the Nation of Islam was much like the mythologies of the world. Then I came back with that understanding of mythology, and I applied the same knowledge that God had blessed me to apply to the mythologies of the world. I applied it to Faraz Muhammad's mythology, and it opened up. That's right. And it opened up. So tell me that that was their doing. That's God's doing. I wasn't interested in that. I was only interested in two. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Praise be to Allah. So they call some shoes wedgies. Wedgies. Your toes are not wedged. They're open.
like that. Open toes means free senses. Free. And symbolism means free senses. They're open. If you wed them, that means you tie them. You bind them. You enslave them. It means enslaved senses. So the duck, he loves water, meaning he loves emotionalism. He loves sensitivity. But water, the same emotional nature, also cleans us. Because if people have no emotional nature, they have no morals. It's the emotional nature where morals come to life, right? Because we feel sorry for something, because we're affected in certain ways, then we are moral people. So actually the base of morality is the emotional nature, you see? So morals and emotion are represented both in the symbol water. So these people are highly morally sensitive, but they are emotional. Emotionally sensitive, highly emotionally sensitive too. And they prefer that to reason. They prefer that to rational teaching. They prefer that. Don't the church people prefer emotionalism to rational teaching? And most of the people in Islam, I mean worldwide, don't they prefer emotionalism to rational teaching? Yes. Most of the religious people of the world, don't they fit in that same description? Yeah, so that's what it represents. The religious blind masses of the world, all of them, put into one boat. So Jesus was crucified, so they say, and they laugh at what they did to the leadership of Christianity. They laugh at it by calling it duck. Quack. Yes, Farad Muhammad, he knew the laugh of the mockers on Christianity, so he made the same laugh on us. Called us 13 ducks. 13 ducks. They, when they have drink the water of the caveman's lake, mean that he had made us spiritually thirsty, curious. We love to go into spiritual things. We want to get into the religion. We were just like ducks. You know, we would go out on the land, and we would go in the air a little bit, but brother, we wanted to get right back to the spiritual teacher. There was our happy ground. The happy ground of the in black Muslims was the spiritual teachings of the Almighty Elijah Muhammad. So he prescribed us as 13 ducks. And he said, when they drank up the water, the caveman's lake. What does it mean? It means when our curiosity have destroyed the emotional content and moral content in religion of the Western society. Now, if that didn't happen, baby, I'm not standing here and opening this message today. You wonder, who messed up the religion? Who messed up the religious sensitivities in the United States, in the West? I will tell you, Farad did it. Through the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Farad did it. Blasting out in the open world that God is the black man and the devil is the white man and the church is a lie. There's nothing after death. This is all of it. Blasting that out for 40-some years, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad poisoned the atmosphere, the moral and spiritual atmosphere of the West. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad poisoned it. And really, he was the main instrument for bringing about the Jacobite plan to unseat religion and morality in Western society. And they did it. That came to be a reality in these last 10 years or 15 years. They have unseated morality and religion in this Western society. Am I right or wrong, brother? All right. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad was the instrument that they used to do that, and the Nation of Islam. So they said what they will do in a minute. You know, Farah Muhammad wouldn't speak with that authority unless he had something. He said, we made him. And we can destroy it overnight in the twinkling of an eye. That's what he said. The Almighty Elijah Muhammad said he said it. Said, brother, we made him, and we can destroy him in the twinkling of an eye. Now, if the same one made us, don't you know secretly they bought both the same thing? We made them. We can destroy them in the twinkling of an eye. Who can they destroy in the twinkling of an eye? The Almighty Elijah Muhammad! In the Nation of Islam.
That's right.
And they did it.
Said, brother, we made it, and we can destroy him in the twinkling of an eye. Now, if the same one made us, don't you know secretly they bought both the same thing? We made them. We can destroy them in the twinkling of an eye. Who can they destroy in the twinkling of an eye? The army like Muhammad and the Nation of Islam.
That's right. That's right.
And they did it.
Right.
After the Nation of Islam had achieved its purpose for them, they destroyed the Nation of Islam in the twinkling of an eye. They brought in bad moral influences, and then the materialistic ideas became the very thing to unseat the Nation of Islam. That's right. Yeah. But they had no idea that a baby would escape the destruction. Allah say, they plan, and I plan, and I'm the best of planners. All praise is due to Allah. Now, let's see here that we cover what we wanted to get here. The highest order in the Christian religion, whether you recognize it or not, is not the Baptists or the Protestants, the Catholics. Catholics represent a protest movement. I mean, the Protestants represent what it says, protest movement. A movement to get more recognition for the masses in the religious establishment. But the real hierarchy is still the Catholic Church. All right? Now, they call their clothes vestments. Vestments. Now, what is the meaning of divestment? To take authority away. Is that right? Or the act of taking away authority. So they call their clothes authority. Vestment, authority. They are saying to the rest of the world that the authority is with us. Some of the other preachers are really, they call it vestments too. But the Catholics, they really use that term almost religiously. Vestments for their clothes, for their clothes. And they have more clothes than anybody else. No kidding. The priest, depending on how high he is, the higher he go, the more clothes. He take off clothes, you think he undressed? He take off one, he ain't undressed. Another one, he still ain't undressed. Another one, and another one, and another one. He got on about 16, 20 or more pieces. I forget how many pieces, a lot of clothes. He's covered up in a lot of different clothes. Come down now to something related to the subject, and that is the word shine. S-H-I-N-E. Shine. Now, you know, the Bible speaks a lot about the light shining. Let the light shine. And there's a thing a lot of spiritual about. Let my light shine. The light gonna shine. It's shine. Shine, shine. A lot of spiritual about shine. So, shine is also talking about wisdom. Shiny metals are precious metals. So, you know, if you say he's bright, it means he's learning, intelligent, right? So shine means the same thing, shine. Now, shoe shine. Shoe shine. Why shoe shining is so popular in the West? You got to get a shoe shine.
Because the fundamental knowledge to them is where the tension should be. How do we know this? Jesus instructed his disciples to wash their feet and to wash each other's feet. Right? Tension is on feet in Christianity. He was seen balancing himself on the water, with feet upon the water. Right? Feet. The tension is on feet. Mary Magdalene is seen in the New Testament crying at his feet and using her hair and tears to clean Jesus' feet. Right? So the tension is on feet. We know that. The tension is on feet. So in the Western society, shoe shining is very important. But they don't like to have, they enjoy the white man, Caucasian European man. He enjoys having a black man, African American, or African, or somebody of that descent. He enjoys having that person shine his shoes. And polish now come in all kind of colors. But polish used to be black. Later they made brown shoes and all kinds. And then, you know, they used to dye the leather black. Black was a thing. But later they made different colors. And now at first the black and brown and white. Now you got all kind of polish, right? All kind of different colors of polish. But it started with black. Black. Why is it so important that the black man shines shoes? So some of you say, oh, that means nothing. Brother, everything in the language of society means something of great importance. It just depends on what context you're speaking or looking at. Speaking in or looking at. Now, so the black man, he's an important man for shining shoes. And I have heard the expression, maybe some of you heard it. Say the white man said this. I don't call you boy, because son, pardon me, because you shine. I call you son because you mine. Some of you might have heard the expression. I don't call you boy, I don't call you son because you shine. I call you son because you mine. So he was distinguishing between S-O-N, son, boy, a child, and S-O-S-U-N, son, the enlightened person. The person that has inherited the knowledge from the Heavenly Father. Son. Okay? S-U-N. So he distinguished between the two and that joke or that mockery of the Belalian man, the African man, by saying, I don't call you a son because you're mine. I call you a son, pardon me. I call you son because you're mine, not because you're shine. And then put him in a position as a shoe shine boy. Don't you know they had us shining shoes so much and depicted us so much as a shoe shine boy until really when the world think now of a shoe shine person, right away our image comes to their mind. No, it's a fact. When they think of anybody shining shoes, right away one of us comes to their mind. Because we have been cast in that position for so long, so much. So what's important? Shoe shine, boy. What's important? Shoe shine means, shine means to make bright. Making bright means either making it bright in knowledge or bright in emotion. Because a person is bright in emotion, they are bright too. The word white, light, bright, all go back to the word happy. In a very ancient language, people associated white with happiness, light with happiness, brightness with happiness. Later on, it became to be associated with enlightenment, learning. Because people were sensitive and happy before they were intelligent. When they got the sciences, then they stopped giving the meaning of white or light or brightness as emotional upliftment, they start giving it as learning, light, enlightenment, pardon me, enlightenment. So that's the progression of that word, that the white or light comes like that. So shoe shine can either mean bringing light of knowledge to the foundation, to the fundamental life,
Or it can mean bringing emotionalism, lifting the spirit of the fundamental life. Now, how does he shine the shoes? That should tell us something about, that should let us know what they mean. He shined the shoes with a rag. A shoe shine rag. Right? So he's ragging the shoe, and that's what they say. Rag the shoe. Right? If you have shined the shoe, you know. Rag the shoe. He's ragging the shoe. So he's shining the shoe with a rag. Rag means a piece of something, or either a used up thing that does not have its original quality. So he's shining the shoe with a rag, but he makes them look mighty good. So who is he representing in that depiction? He's representing the dumb preacher. He represents the dumb preacher who takes a piece of the book that's really a rag of the book. He takes a piece of the book that's really nothing but a rag in his hand, and he signs the souls of the people. He shines the shoes, but the shoes represent the soul. He shines the souls of the people with his rags, or with his raggedy religion. Excuse me for doing this. They did it. I'm just telling you what they say. So he shines the shoes. Now tell me, who made Christianity lively in this country? Wasn't it the shoe shine boy? Wasn't it our folks? Our preacher made this religion lively. The spiritual, the old black spiritual, all of that is what really popularized Christianity and turned it into a shining religion in the West. Those early Gentiles were either so bookish minded, so academic minded, so logical minded, that they couldn't do nothing but just lock themselves up in discussions of theology, fine discussions of the logic of the theology of Christianity, or they were nuts out here in the society, wild and crazy, fine brimstone preachers, right? Calvin and the Calvinists. You know about them in history. Yeah. Selling spookism and superstition. A bunch of dumb people. That's what they were. And the religion was nothing but a mockery in this country. Except for the exclusive quarter of the learned people in Christianity. They represented a small minority. And they were not seen present out in the society. Only in institutions of learning, right? Yeah. But it was the masses of the European and Caucasian people that gave Christianity a real primitive pagan look. They preach horrible things, frighten the people into becoming converts, act crazy, act like wild, crazy people. Some of you maybe not haven't been to that church. I have. I've been to some of their churches. When I was a young man, I went to see what they were doing. And they're crazy. They were crazy people. Yeah, they were just drumming fear up in you and everything. There was a few talking good, you know, like the Quakers, brotherly love and decency and human decency, and a few others. But for the whole, the Western world was that Calvinist mentality. Right or wrong, you all correct me if I'm wrong. The Christian masses of the Western world was of that Calvinist mentality. But the Negro, with his freedom movement, his movement to get recognition to his human and social aspirations, he gave a human touch and a human sensitivity to the church. That's right. It was through the black man of America, the African American, that Christianity in America and in the West began to shine. I mean, it began to appeal to the likings of the people. That's what it means. It began to be attractive. It began to be attractive. The black man made it attractive. By doing what? By shining the soul with a rag. Yeah. By shining the soul with a rag. The foot, the shoe is symbolic of the soul. So actually the shoe covered the whole foot, But it's symbolic of the soul. Shu in Egyptian mythology, in Egyptian language, meant the spiritual ascendancy. And that's of the nature of the soul. It's the soul. The soul in its ascendancy. You see? So Shu brings that, but it covers the whole foot. Now, they call the soul the tendon, the very sensitive part of the foot down there, right? That's your soul. Now you look, the soul has an arch, right? It has an arch. And that arch is uplifted. It keeps that part of the foot off the ground, right? So actually, that part resembles the drawing of Shu in Egyptian mythology. In Egyptian mythology, Shu is drawn as a man standing on the ground with his body bending like that, going all the way up into the sky, and his hands on the ground. Nothing touching but his hands and his toes like this on the ground. His fingers like this. I'll do it.
This is how Shu is. His head's out of this. Body arch. And he represents the sky arch. And by interpretation, he represents spiritualism. Spiritualism.
And they connect that symbol with your foot, and that's why Shu must say Shu. They may call it news, they may call it wedges, they may call it a lot of things to describe what is happening in the seasonal manipulation of your mind, but they always keep that one word, Shu. Okay, I think we about covered that pretty good. Yeah. All right. Just a few comments, and we thank you. Now, polish. Polish. The polish and the shoe is what shines it, right? Another word for polish is what? Wax. Wax, right? Wax, what does wax mean? To seal. Bring together. It's to bring together. But wax is used as a sealer, right? And it seals up worn places or holes. It just covers it over, right? So it hides the damage, and it protects the damage from exposure, right? But it doesn't heal. That shoe ain't healed. That's the same old raggedy worn out shoe, man. It's just covered. The polish has covered it over and been shined up to make it look like it's bright and new. But it's the same old worn out shoe. Now, yes, it's called polish. Now what is polish? Means something to make shine, to make bright, to make shine. And it's a paste, right, or wax. And what is it made out of? Fine powder, right? It's so fine that it has no grit. Smooth as it can get. It's been fined down so much, it's real smooth, like grease. But it's not grease, it's actually polish. It's different. So wax-like, polish. Okay. Look at the word fine now. Fine. Look at the word fine in the word refine. And look, why they have a word like this with fine in it? Confine. Fine, refine, confine. Why would you want to lock up something fine? So they say confine means to lock up, right? I can understand that fine means bright, good. I can see why you would refine something, means bring it back to its fineness, right? But I can't see why you would confine something. It doesn't make too much sense. But if we are talking about knowledge, knowledge is fine in the Bible, also means brilliant, wise, bright, intelligent, if it applies not to physical things so much, but to the essence, to the wisdom, principles, etc., then I can understand it. Because I know that's what they have done. They have confined, they have locked up knowledge. Right? So they say they put you in a prison. They confine you. So here, I knew it was something we left out. Let me get close it up here. Here, they confine you by putting you into a prison. P-R-I-S-O-N. But they also have something they call a P-R-I-S-M, prism. And some of the people in this society, they don't call prison prison. They call it prism. Yeah, he's in prison. He's in prison. They don't say prison. Just listen. And you hear somebody say prison. Oh, they in prison here. In prison. They imprison him. Instead of saying imprisoned him. They imprisoned him. He was in prison. Oh, he's in prison. Instead of saying in prison, they cut it short and it sounds like in prison. Like a prison, P-R-I-S-M, you see? Prison. Okay, prism means what? Prism is a solid with a certain design. And it's transparent. It's what they call homogeneous, consistent throughout. Whatever, it can't be made of different kinds of material, impure. It's whatever it is in one part of it, it's that throughout. And its shape is consistent. Its pattern is very consistent, uniform and consistent. It has three sides. Built like an angle, in the shape of an angle, and it permits a spectrum, a light to come into it, pardon me, and it shows the spectrum of that light, right? It shows the light in its different colors. So in other words, it manifests the hidden components of light, right? It reveals the hidden components of light. Then they have a word called prison, which is made to confine. Right? So, what is the prison symbolic of then? Why they got to have prison? Don't you know prisons are too costly for civilization now? There's another way to handle that. They have to do them, but bring them out there and beat the shit out of them and kill some of them and it'll be all right, be done. They could control crime much better by not building any house for any criminal. Just bring him out, just bring him before the public TV and beat his butt real good. Send him on back home. That's all. Cost the taxpayers nothing but a few moments on the TV. Few moments to watch public television. That's all. Yeah. Beat him real good. Send him on back home. Or kill him and bury him on national TV. Same day. Yeah, that's all it takes, and it could be much better. But prison is a necessity in the scheme of this world. It's part of their language scheme. They have to keep it. Part of the game. Part of the criminal economics. They need it. They have to have it. Now, dear beloved people, we have shared with you things that will make heaven and earth rock and shake and go into convulsion. Well, if it wasn't time, I wouldn't be able to say it. That's right. It's time. Then they got another prison inside the prison. Solitary confinement. Yeah, solitary confinement. So they tell you that they got two programs for the three people. One is to restrict their freedom. And the other one is to deny them any opportunity to express themselves to anybody. Except them own, except themselves. And you tell me if that ain't the program of this society? If they don't like what you're saying, they limit your exposure to only your own self. That's solitary confinement. But everybody out there is in jail. They just confined. But the Muslims, we are in solitary confinement. They don't want us on the media. They don't want us reaching the masses of people because they don't want what we got to say reaching other minds. You see? So that's solitary confinement for us. We are in a prison within the prison. But we don't mind. I think they did the same thing to Joseph, didn't they? And finally got in so much trouble, they had to go and get him out. Say, hey, man, we heard you might be able to help us. And you never can tell, that may happen again. Yeah, they might get in so much trouble, they might say, no. It hurts me to my heart. It tears my liver out. But can you tell that Muhammad, what is his, what's his name? war with Dean? Yeah, war with Dean. We like to talk to him. And war with Dean! Yeah, that's what I war with. I war with the dean. Assalamu alaikum.
Don't let him take it, no. Don't let him take it, no.
from behind. Try to take what God can do. That is your mind. That's why we say fight. Come on and fight, people.
Don't let him take your mind.
Don't let him take it, no.
Fight.
الحمد لله رب العالمين وبسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمد رسول الله. People of brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa barakatuh. Thank you for being with us this morning for Universal Dimensions of Leadership. Universal Dimensions of Leadership. Got distracted. All things human. Alhamdulillah. We're in the midst of changes. Due to the lateness of the hour, we played a larger portion of Imam Muhammad than the hour that we strive for often. I'm not going to invite comments this morning. I want to continue with the subject, human language and the Holy Quran. Human language and the Holy Quran. Actually, better said, probably be human language and the language of the Holy Quran, which is actually what we're talking about. We feel good about what we've said about it so far. So if you've been with us on the Wednesday mornings, then you have a nice flow of that information. And if you haven't been, then I recommend you go back on Facebook. You have it, and also Blog Talk Radio. Very useful to understand, and I'm not going to take any more time focusing on that. Let's go ahead and get to some new material, because I know you should be anticipating and longing for, okay, give me that concrete Quran piece there. That's what I want to do. So let's do a quick summary of what we touched on last week. Okay, we based our comments on an article by a Michael Egnor, E-G-N-O-R, in Evolution News and Science Today. You can find it, go on the website, and say why do human beings have language or something like that. But the main thing is the author, Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, Egnor, E-G-N-O-R. And he has put in human language, it more likely will come up for you. Just to categorically point out that language, there are signs, and there are two types of signs. Signs are things that direct you to something, direct your attention to something. And there are two types. There are signals and there are designators. Signals can be noises, gestures, or objects that direct your attention to something else in the immediate environment. So if I point somewhere, then I'm taking your attention, I'm sending your attention over there. And so it is with signals. If you hear a noise somewhere, then that noise draws your attention to something in your immediate environment. So the point is, it can be noise, gestures, or objects that direct your attention to something else in the immediate environment, and that's more so the key. You take those two things, attention, immediate environment, maybe even saying direct attention to the immediate environment, direct attention within the immediate environment. All right, so that's signs breaking down into two, signals and designators. Signals are what I just talked about, noise, gestures, objects, directing your attention to something in the immediate environment. Now, words, this is where the distinction comes in. A word is a designator. A word is a sign, yes, but it is a designator. Now, as a word, pardon me, designator, a word as a designator, it directs your attention to something abstractly that's not like what's being you're being directed to, and it's not necessarily in your immediate environment, right? So a word, since we're talking abstracts, we're going to move fast. Liberty, right? So if I use the term liberty, then liberty is not a noise. Liberty is not a gesture. Liberty is not an object, right? Liberty is a word. Liberty is a word. But what does it do? It directs your attention to something abstractly that is not like it, right? So a word, you don't have any form for the word. You hear me say it. There's no form for the word. But the word, it reaches your mind, and it directs your attention to something. Now, in this case, liberty is something abstract, and obviously, as history has shown, liberty has to be explained, expressed, defined, et cetera, so that people can know what it is in that sense. And human beings have the capacity for understanding such abstracts, and that's the power of words. The power of words is to bring our attention, which also brings to bear our power as minds, hearts, what have you, as beings. Words have the power to move all of our energy and all of our power and all of our attention towards the things that the words are designating, all right? And so the point is just understand just a word. Just think about words, period, just words. Every time you hear somebody talking, you're hearing words, right? All right, but know what words are. Words are something abstract that are not like the things that they talk about. I say the word fire. And that word fire is not like that thing fire, but it can draw your attention to fire. Okay, that's the power of a word. So what distinguishes a word from a signal is that a word directs your attention to an object abstractly. A word bears no physical relationship, which we said. I gave the example of fire. Words allow us to designate, that is to point to designate, identify, name, right? Words allow us to designate and therefore think about. That's another big chunk of this whole thing. Words produce thoughts. Words carry thoughts. You can put a thought in a word and send a word to somebody else, and that word can be reformed in that person's mind and consciousness. That thought can be received. That thought can be received and embraced by the person that receives it. All right? All of this with word. So a word allows us to designate and therefore think about and talk about things beyond our physical environment. That's a very powerful thing. That, you know, just put an animal in your mind, whatever, bears. You know, you got two bears sitting around. Those bears are not having a conversation. You know, even though bears and all other animals, they have their ways of communicating to each other, but they are not dealing in abstracts. They're dealing in very concrete things, right, in terms of threats, in terms of possibilities, all of those kinds of things. They interact with each other on instinct in that regard, and certain things do give signs that would tell them either to fight or flee or what have you. All right. So, but human beings, when human beings sit down and quote unquote interact with each other, we use words. And we use these words, and these words are talking about things not in our immediate environment. We can talk about yesterday. We can talk about tomorrow. We can talk about things that, whatever, things we remember, you know, all of that goes along the same way. So, and that's a big distinction. So the word, so words, i.e. human language, and what words do as opposed to signs as signals, is a big difference, very, very important. Words allow us to designate and think about and talk about things that are beyond our physical environment. The abstract nature of words, along with grammar, and that's the thing. So now you know words. Animals don't have words. Human beings have words. But even though a human being has words, though a human being has words, it's not until those words have a grammar that it becomes language. So language is words plus grammar. Words plus grammar equals language, right? And you could, I believe, put meaning parenthetically alongside that term language, right? Because words plus grammar make meaning possible. You get meaning from words that are set to a grammar. Words set to a grammar give meaning. That is very, very important because we live on meaning. We live on meaning. Meaning is the food of the mind. Meaning is the food of the mind. In fact, alhamdulillah, rabbil alamin, just right here, mufid. The Arabic term for meaning is mufid, meaning it's beneficial. But you hear feed in the Arabic word, mufid. You hear feed. Meaning is what feeds you. Meaning is what feeds you. And if you're not getting meaning from what you're reading, then you're not being fed. And so, you know, the whole much can be done with that after that Quran, that which is to be read. And in the language of Imam Muhammad, be read, put it together, B-R-E-A-D, bread. And then the rest of it, and man shall not live by bread alone, but from every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. So it's all there. So understand, words are different from animal communications. Animals don't have words. Get it out of your mind. Animals don't have words. Humans have words. Now, a human being can have words, but if the words are not set to a grammar, then it is not language. And if it's not language, then it has no meaning. But when you have words plus grammar, then you have language, and you derive from that meaning. In fact, that's the only way. If you want to speak German, French, Spanish, Arabic, English, or what have you, then you can listen to a Spanish-speaking person, but if you don't know the words and if you don't know the grammar, then you don't know what they mean. But the way you can learn how to communicate with someone of that language is to learn their words, learn their grammar, and there you go. All right. Only human beings have language. So now we know language is the combination of words plus grammar. Only human beings have language. Only human beings have language, right? And what is language? Language is a system of abstract signs. It has signs, right? Signs. So now, even let's keep it, you know, simple, reachable. In the Arabic, we have the harakat, right? You have the harakat. Which is speaking to the way that the words are voweled, the way that the words are voweled, and especially in grammar, in the Arabic grammar, then it is speaking to the position. It's speaking to the position. All grammar is talking about the position of words and sentence. I was thinking about the vowel at the end, the voweling at the end of it. Those are signs. Those are symbols, right? Feta, dhamma, kesa, fetatain, kesatain, etc. And other endings in conjunction with other words that either precede the word taking the vowel or the word ending in the way that it ends. All that, understanding those things is to understand the grammar of the Arabic. And to do so, that's how the meaning, that's one of the ways, of course, of deriving meaning. So feta, dhamma, kasra, you know, those are signs in the Arabic grammatic system, right? so that, and that's what language is. Language is a system of abstract signs. So when you look at feta, it is saying something, right? So it as a sign is a symbol, and it is abstract. It's abstract because pointing to something else. It's there in the word, but it's telling you something else. For example, feta in many cases is a sign of something being the object of a verb. Something being the object of a verb. So in that position, it's just a concrete sign. It's a literal mark, right? But that mark is just simply a sign to point to something else, which is the condition of the word, and also that means also the meaning of the word. All right, so let's think about ourselves just to understand. Language is a system of abstract signs. Language is a system of abstract signs. And it's grammar that give words or allow words or enable words to make sense and to transmit meaning. Now, the purpose of language is to make human thought possible. Think about it. When we say make human thought possible, I don't know, you know. Try to think of something for which there is no word. There's no word for it. Think about something that there's no word for. I'll say it again. Think about something that there is no word for. You can't think about something there is no word for. So that's one of the ways to understand immediately that language is what makes human thought possible. Language is what makes human thought possible. Now, human thought is different than consciousness. For those of you with us, Karaj Lal Institute, we went through life within and life without the body. We dealt with that. So thought is one of the properties in our consciousness. Thought is one of the properties in our consciousness. Just because a person is conscious doesn't mean that they're thinking. All right? So the point is, thought is a property in human consciousness, and the purpose of language is to make human thought possible. So human thought is abstract thought, in essence. Human thought is abstract thought. Human thought is the ability to think beyond your immediate environment, your immediate circumstances. Right? It's important to understand the ways in which human thought differs from animal thought. Human thought is abstract, right? And we are able to think about broader things. This author says they contemplate universals, right? And that's true. We can contemplate love, joy, happiness, freedom, peace, all the other things that we as human beings value. The ta'amaruna bil ma'ruf, the ma'ruf, all of those excellent things and those things known to be excellent in the history of man. So these are all possible because of human language. Listen. You know, it may be trite, but this is also the season and something of a cliche for some. But when you think about it from a historical and from a human perspective, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. I mean, there's so much in that. Rights, that's a word, abstract, speaking to what? Unalienable, but it just goes on and on. So, but this is that language, as instituted and constituted in this geography, no matter how hypocritical some may be to it, it is established in the mind, in the consciousness of America and the world. And it is, yes, there's still an experiment we're undergoing. It's not dead. It may seem so in some way. It's not dead. It's very powerful. And it is something that is very rich as a hope, as an aspiration to continue to be aspired to. And any other language that's designed to undermine that language is not good language, right? Doesn't matter how right it might feel to you. It's not good language. Now listen. Quranic language is higher than higher than that language. Quranic language is higher than that language. We're not going to go into that right now. But it accepts that language. Excuse me. Embraces that language. In fact, we know that that language actually came from the Quran, but English can only do so much. It is truly the thought in the Quranic words that have the most power. So we have to do more to refine that, the understanding of it. In fact, I don't know the title of the book. Islam and I think it's Islam and Democracy. I believe Imam Rawat just published another of those conversations with the Imam under the title, that is, in this case, is under the title Islam and Democracy, I think, mashallah. So I'm sure inside of that is more of what I'm talking about coming from the Imam, but I want to go further down the road on these ideas right now. So human thought, humans think abstractly. Again, human being can think about yesterday. Human being can think about tomorrow. Human being can make plans. Human beings can converse. I have an idea in my head. I can transmit that idea to the head of someone else, and they can do the same for me. And so now we're sharing thoughts. We're sharing ideas, and we're talking about abstracts and the like. That's human. That's human. Very important. I'll say now that's just human. All right. But now, what about when human beings start talking to each other about words in the Quran? Words in the Quran, not words in the New York Times or in the Los Angeles Times or whatever. No, what God said in the Quran. And then they exchange that. That's powerful, if we really understood. So human beings are able to contemplate universals abstracted from particular things. That is, human beings are able to look at a tree and get much more out of it, to put it lightly, than any animal. Animals cannot get anything abstractly from that tree. In terms of what? Meaning. The interest of an animal in a tree is the food, the protection, whatever they might get in immediacy from it. But as far as a human being is concerned, human being can look at a tree, certainly now, and he can see a house, not living in the tree, but cutting down the tree and getting the lumber, the timber from it, and making a house, and so many other implements from it. Why? Because of his thinking, and because of his different thinking, then his behavior in line with that distinct thinking makes the world that we're living in right now. So if you have higher ideas, higher thoughts, more profound understanding of the nature of creation, that's how we get the bigger and better things creation, by thinking more into and abstracting more out of the physical environment. Without language, we could not think abstractly, okay? We have airplanes because of abstract thinking. We have automobiles because of abstract thinking. We have computers because of abstract thinking. Everything that we have from a civilizational point of view is because of our capacity for thinking abstractly, right? And that's just the nature. That's just the nature of human thought. So the capacity of human beings to think abstractly is what has made human progress possible. The capacity in human beings to think abstractly is what has made civilization possible. The people who don't make progress are the people who think less abstractly. And when you think less abstractly, then that means you're digressing, you're going more toward the animal. That's a part of the hook in the plot in the last Planet of the Apes movie. The direction of language. The apes were moving more towards human language, and the human beings were losing their capacity for language, all right? And so it's pointed out that the distinction, what makes a person quote-unquote human, if you will, is actually their language, because you can say by that representation that the human beings were becoming more like beasts and animals and inhuman, and the beast and animals were becoming more like humans. But what was happening at the same time, or rather, this is reflected in the fact that one is losing language, human language, and the other is gaining human language. All right. So why do we have language? We have language so that we can think in a human way. We have language so that we can think in a human way. And we have language because language is a system of abstract signs, and abstract signs are necessary for abstract thought. And abstract thought is what makes us human. Say it again. We have language because language is a system of abstract signs. The abstract signs are necessary for abstract thought. And abstract thought is what makes us human. Being able to think abstractly, being able to think about ideas, that's human. You know, there's nothing in our immediate environment that we can think of. And so this whole AI thing, I won't even go into that. But I think the simplest refutation of the idea of people thinking that someday robots are going to replace us, or robots are going to become conscious. It's the numbers are so ridiculous that, hold on, let me see. I want to just give you the, if I can't, I have to give it up. Let's see, I'm going to have to give it up. Yes, too much to go through right now. But the idea is that it takes, there's really no replication of how much computational power there is in the human brain for that to be replicated, and even the replication, which is not going to happen, but even if it was replicated, it still would not create consciousness. I got to get away from this. It wouldn't create consciousness. The point is that understanding, as an example, when we say we understand something, understanding is not computational. Everything that people talk about, artificial intelligence, computers, et cetera, computers, if it's coming from a computer, is computational. Computers do computational things. Understanding is not computational. Understanding is abstract. So you can do the calculations, but once you finish the calculations, then there has to be an understanding. But we'll get to that another time. Let's cover a little more on the grammatical logic of the original Arabic. Now, the eloquence, so now we're going into the power of Quranic language. You got human language and the nature of human language. Now we're talking about the language of God, basically, from the Quran, from a Quranic perspective, though God is not an Arab, okay? The eloquence and poetry of the Arab was legendary before the Quranic revelation. The poetry of the Arab was legendary before the Quranic revelation. Some scholars say that those people were actually called Arab because the term alludes to the beauty of their language. So there was a recognition even before that about the language of the Arabs. Even so, before the Quran, the Arabs themselves had not codified the grammar of their own native tongue. Now, we said this in part, but we want to understand the value of the distinction of that. So if the language is beautiful, well, they had to have a grammar, you might say. Well, yeah, but it was an esoteric language, right? So you have esoteric, exoteric. Okay, esoteric, it means that it was confined really to them. But at the same time, so within their circles, yes, they had the grammar, but it was oral. It was not literal, et cetera. It was not written down. It was language. It was oral, right? And so it was beautiful, and it had its grammar, but the grammar was understood by the people who already spoke that language. So for that reason, it was esoteric. It was not exoteric. It was not a language that could travel because of the fact that it had not been codified in a way that somebody else can grasp its grammar who's not a native language speaker of that Arabic. So it hadn't even reached that. So that point, before the Quran, even though the language is beautiful, the language still had not been codified in a formal grammar. It had this native grammar because it was their native tongue. Now, why is this? This is because prior to the revelation of the Quran, the Arab intellect hadn't risen to the level of grammar. They hadn't become a literary society. You think about it. Before Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the coming of the Quran, the Arab society, such as it was not a literary society. It was an oral society. So the idea of it having an explicit exoteric grammar, a codified grammar that could be received and transmitted to others in ways other than the oral method. An article from the New Yorker, on the history of Arabia. This person discovered a stone somewhere. I'll read what they mentioned. It said, the history of Arabia just before the birth of Islam is a profound mystery. The history of Arabia just before the birth of Islam, because remember, they were not a literary society, so for as far as written histories and all that, that wasn't their way, right? A few written sources describing the milieu in which Muhammad lived, that was what was existing before the coming of the Quran and al-Islam. Historians had long believed that the Bedouin nomads who lived in the area composed poetry to record the feats, F-E-A-T-S, of their tribes, but had no system for writing it down. They were not a literary society. This was before the coming of the Quran and al-Islam. This kind of society would have been very similar to the first audience of the Quran. So the first audience of the Quran, it was the richness and the power of it in its sounds, in its words, as compared to what had been glorified in their language before the coming of the Quran. That they had their shine was the poet. Right? So here Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reveals to Muhammad, who wasn't a part of their society in the context of this eloquence of poetry and its competitions and all that, but then he brings something that none of them can match. I'll find that story, that very rich story about someone taking one of the chapters from the Quran. I'm not sure. I think it might be Surah Al-Ikhlas. I'm not sure. That they would post some so there was some who had written, because otherwise that could not have been possible. And also we know that during the time of the Prophet there were treaties. There were some people who were literate in that sense, but that was not the society at large, and the formalized grammar yet and still was not in place. So in any case, so the point is here again, other historians of language pointing out that there was no written language at that time. We have a lot to say from the imam in that regard, but I don't think we're going to be able to get to it today. I have here my notes in the Quran 14:4. It says, the messengers, whenever Allah sends a messenger, he sends them speaking the language of the people to whom they are sent. And not looking at the Arabic, the idea is that in this case, and no doubt others, speaking their language. So it's not in the form of a book, in writing in that sense. It's the language that they speak. From a Quranic perspective, the Quranic language is the original non-literary Arabic given structure and grammar. That is, the Quranic language is that original Arabic language set to a grammatic structure, set to a grammatic structure. To better understand what that means, we need to revisit a portion of Imam Muhammad's 1997 quote. The Imam spoke of how language and civilization evolved in human society. He said, man comes up with communication for him and his people in his family or in his environment, a common language that's like the desert Arabs of the location of the oral Arabic, the non-literary Arabic that was existing before the Quran was revealed, and of course, before Muhammad himself was born. The Imam goes on and says, the Imam states, that just nature itself, not the brain so much, but nature itself played a great role in bringing people to form some kind of language for communicating between one another. So we're going back early history. We learned how, that is, any given tribe or any group of people that lived together, they came up with ways to communicate between each other. And then the intellect took over after a certain period of time. Then an intellect comes in among that group, right? Meaning comes in among, meaning come, it comes out of that group. It's not like a foreigner comes from the outside and says, let me help y'all out. No, it comes up from within. That instinct develops among the people with those that have that particular proclivity. And when that intelligence takes over, then they start to refine that language. I'm quoting the Imam, and ultimately that brought those people into a logic for their language that is called its grammar. So grammar also grows and evolves and is what some might say an epiphenomena of just speaking. That is, we are a tribe, an ancient tribe. Doesn't matter what language, what people, what geography, we're an ancient tribe. Our existence, we've come up together as a group. We know how to talk to each other, et cetera, et cetera, and that's fine. So for millennia, whatever, we talk to each other. At some point in time, an intelligentsia arrives from us that begins to codify our language, give our language structure. Why? Because that nature calls for it. Circumstances call for it. The pressure of situations call for a refinement. Ultimately, grammar is the outcome of that kind of pressure, right? And that's how we get it. So, well, in the case of the Arab, the arrival of that intellect equates to the arrival of the Quran, right? As of the time of the Quranic revelation, the intellect of the Arabs of that time had not yet taken over. This is Allah coming in and saying, look, I got this, okay? We cultivated, we stimulated, we evolved, we brought about the beauty, the eloquence of this language from a native perspective, from a natural perspective, from the ground up, if you will. Now, I am going to send the structure. I'm going to send the grammar for this naturally beautiful language. So now when this naturally beautiful language is put into the structure that I give to it, now it's going to be more powerful than the Arabic human language. You don't even need to speak about the other languages that it will supersede. That is what the Quranic Arabic is, right? So in the case of the Arabs, as of the time of the Quranic revelation, the intellect of the Arab had not yet taken over. And indeed, the very time of the coming of the Quranic revelation was called Jahiliyyah, the time of ignorance. All right? So, mashallah, so we'll leave that there for now and follow a little more to just close out the idea. But you should feel or be clear with more supports, I'll say. The superiority of the Quranic Arabic language, it transcends all language. The whatever, the ethnic Arabic, the national Arabic tongues all across the world, wherever they may be, the English language, French, Latin, German, whatever. The Quranic language is the best language that is, because it is in the Quran and the Quran is in the world. So it is the best language in the world. To do what? To do what languages do. And what do languages do? Make all things for human beings possible. Language. So we have a book that has the best language that can be used on earth for human progress. That's what we have. To learn that language is to learn what it takes to have real power as intended by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Don't think in whatever, just political terms or whatever, just power, the power, especially in the interest of serving Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's it. All right. Alhamdulillah. Thank you so much. Inshallah. Everybody have a wonderful day. Inshallah. More content coming. Check in with the clearunderstanding.institute. The site is live right now, and more content coming on a regular basis. Be there. God's peace be on you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.